On the Wintrust Business Lunch, we want to talk a little bit about the business of buy-downs, how to get the rate lower. Here's John Cordell, who is the Director of Development Management and Operations in the Central Region at Lendlease. Hey, John, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
What does Lendlease do? Who are you guys?
Lendlease is an international developer based in Sydney, Australia. And here in Chicago, over the last 6 years, we've delivered about 2,300 units in five towers. And they're all very close to the urban core downtown. Most recently, the Reed, which is on the river just south of the Loop, kitty corner to the old post office, is a 440-unit hybrid condo and rental building, along with Cirrus, which was delivered in 2022, right along the lakefront, just south of the river.
So you all developed
another
that?
350.
You all own that? That's your property?
That. We own and develop that, correct. We have a joint venture at Cirrus with Magellan, and we own the Reed outright.
So how's business, John?
Business has been choppy, but pretty good in April. The higher interest rates, I think, have been really understood by the buyers at this point. And the idea that sitting on the sidelines and waiting for a sudden interest rate reduction is probably not in the immediately near term.
Yeah.
And so people are making decisions. Month to date, we've actually sold 11 homes between our two buildings, which is a notable increase from the last couple months. So April has been good thus far.
What are those units going for?
They start in the 399 range at the Reed and go up to about $1.5 million. And at Cirrus, they start in the upper 400s and go up to $5 million for the penthouses.
Does the conversation ever go like this? 7% isn't a bad number. 6.5 is not a bad number. Historically, that's pretty good. It's about average. So don't wait for 3% to come along. You can afford 7%. Is that the pitch?
I think that is the pitch. I think with new development, we're able to offer developer credits that can be used to offset in old times customization for a unit or maybe part of the closing costs. But most recently, our buyers have been taking advantage of the buy-down program.
Yeah.
So they're applying a developer credit of 2-3% of the purchase price towards buying down a mortgage. And everyone sort of has a different opinion or expectation on when they want to either refinance or sell their home. And so we have three preferred lenders at the Reed. Wintrust, the sponsor of this lunch, is one of them, along with Proper Rate, that is part of Guaranteed Rate, and also Federal Savings Bank. And we basically have worked with them to pre-approve the building and create, I don't want to say pre-negotiated because it moves every day based on interest rates, but a pre-arranged relationship so that our credit can be applied directly to a buy-down for the buyer's particular situation. And an example, a recent example, a buyer bought about $1 million home with an $800,000 mortgage, and a 30-year fixed rate is around 7.5%, and they used a 3.0 buy down to buy it all the way down to 4.5% for 1 year. And that allows them to save, you know, $1,500 a month in payment. So about $15,000 over the year. And it's utilizing the developer credit that they could have used, to offset closing costs. But in this case, they believe that in a year, rates might come down a little bit and I can refinance. If not, I'm fixed at 7.5% for 30 years. So that is how that particular buyer approached that.
Yeah, I get that. But I wonder, one last question about this. How is your buy-down program different? Anybody could anytime go to a close and say, I just want to buy down the rate. I'll put more money down, right? Isn't that how you affect a buy-down traditionally?
Sure, but developer credits, and any buyer can come and apply, you know, part of their equity payment to points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but where we're different is it's coming from the seller. So it's not a buyer paying points. It's coming from the seller side. And sure, a resale could try to apply these credits, but you're going to run into appraisal issues and other restrictions by the lender. You know, we are in the unique situation where the mortgage bankers treat new construction a little differently. They know that these appraise well in the market, and so that's really our flexibility.
What a novel idea. What a good program. And it's at LendLease.com. Is that where folks where do you want to send our listeners, John?
Yeah, I would go TheReedCondos.com or CirrusCondos.com would be the two places to look at it. And we'd love to show you a brand new home on the lake or on the river.
Yeah, I know that building. It is beautiful. Well done. Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
That's John Cardell with LendLease.com and those two properties on the lake and river. From CNET.com, senior writer Bree Fowler is here. Hi, Bree. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
How are your calves?
I am doing better, but Monday was definitely hard.
Bree ran the Boston Marathon, as did producer Pete's wife, Molly. I suppose you know that too, huh?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was a crazy hot day that nobody expected. Definitely a lot of runners hurting out there that day.
I saw some of the people wobbling over the finish line, literally being helped by police. And I thought, maybe you shouldn't be helping that person. You should just let them not finish and get an ambulance. But some of them were so close, you know, like 50 yards away. They wobbled across.
Yeah, I think as being in the media, you learn how to smile for the camera no matter what. So I look good coming across the finish line, but miles leading up to it were pretty darn hard.
So were you happy with your performance?
Yeah, I cut 25 minutes off my New York City marathon time.
Wow.
So, you know, despite the heat, I did better than my last run. So I'm happy.
Do you want to share your time with us?
No, that's okay. I definitely was back at the pack. You know, this is something I got to do because I am a member of the media. I'm not a Boston qualifier. You know, you always keep working hard, keep working better and running smarter even as we get older.
Well, congratulations to you. It's not why we called, but I wanted to know that. Let's
Thank
talk about
you.
The Biden administration has reached a deal to provide $6.1 billion in government support for Micron technology. This is part of the CHIPS Act, and this is what that money that, lo and behold, the Congress was able to actually pass. This is part of where that money's going, huh?
Yeah, $6.1 billion in government support is going to upstate New York to help produce advanced memory computer chips. Upstate New York and Idaho, which is the home state of Micron. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who represents us here in New York, pushed for this. And there's going to be four new chip factories near Syracuse and the town of Clay, which is also upstate.
So how does that work? Does the government give that money to that company, or how does that transaction happen?
You know, I'm not quite sure exactly. You know, there's usually grants, there's loans, things like that. Micron itself is going to be sinking $100 billion into upstate New York over the next 20 years.
Wow.
So $6.1 billion, while that is a ton of money to me, is a drop in the bucket compared to what the company is going to be spending.
Yeah.
The idea is that it's going to result in 9,000 direct jobs and 40,000 construction jobs.
Talk to me about Elon Musk's pay package.
Yeah. This has been going on for a while now. Back in January, a judge rejected a push to restore Musk's $56 billion pay package that he was supposed to get, that his board voted to approve for him. But, you know, shareholders sued, saying that Musk controls the board and therefore this wasn't exactly fair. It's now Tesla is asking them to restore that. But now it might be a bit of a tough sell. Tesla has not been doing so great lately. Its stock's down recently. The model lineup's aging. And there's just not as much demand for electronic vehicles this year.
Isn't it strange that while everybody agrees that electric vehicles are the future, Is it not the problem that it's not the electric vehicles, it's the infrastructure to support them? Tesla may have its own issues, but I mean, one of the reasons that we're cool on electric right now is not that we don't like or believe in electric cars.
Right. I mean, back when I used to cover the auto industry, when I was living in Detroit, they referred to it as range anxiety. You know, you just didn't have that many fueling stations out there. You had to know where they were. And, you know, did you really want to do a cross-country road trip in an electric vehicle when you have to worry about finding a charging station in the middle of Iowa or something? I mean, people have been open to buying these, especially when the tax incentives have been good for a second vehicle. But making it a primary vehicle is something that a lot of people would have concerns about doing.
When we hear about scams on the internet, we always wonder who those people are, and we wish just once some of them would get caught. In London, they actually did arrest some people, right?
Yeah, this actually came down today. It's super interesting. Police in London said that they disrupted a website that basically let fraudsters create websites that tricked 70,000 British people into revealing personal information like their bank account numbers and passwords. Basically, this was a site that sold, you know, templates and, you know, fake website how-tos to create things that looked like a legitimate bank or healthcare or a postal service website. People thought they were going to the real thing. They entered their credentials and that information was stolen.
Well, we're certainly familiar with that here. All of us always get these pitches, these email, and it looks like it's your bank, and it's not. And you got to be really careful about that. This is the people that make those sites, huh?
Yeah. I mean, what's really gotten scary about cybercrime these days is, you know, back in the day, you actually had to have some serious computer skills to pull one off. Now you can just buy everything you need for, you know, this kind of phishing attack or ransomware or a botnet that could, you know, take down a website. All of that is just for sale online now, and really just about anybody could pull it off.
What did I see? Like for just a couple $100 a month, it would be like a legitimate business that had a legitimate bill, a monthly service fee, and this was what the fake companies were doing, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. And they were able to reveal 480,000 bank card numbers and 64,000 PIN numbers. I mean, they're still investigating, so who really knows? But the British police were able to infiltrate this, and they've arrested 37 people so far. And another 800 people have been warned that the police know who they are.
I hope they keep them in jail for a long time. Bree Fowler is a senior writer at CNET. Thank you, Bree.
Thanks for having me.
Now with Michael Miller, the economics professor at Western Washington University, longtime guest on this show, a professor emeritus at DePaul University and a regular professor there for quite some time. He's headed out west, but he still joins us. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing very well, John, and thank you for the invitation to come back.
You sound robust, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been teaching, and it's very revitalizing. I had 3 months of retirement, and that was enough. I had to get back in the classroom, and I'm enjoying it very much.
And we always enjoy your insight here, although today you want to just kind of give us a little economics 101 about inflation. And I read what you had to say about that, and I think it would help us. So let's start with that, this sort of yin and yang of the economy right now.
Yeah, you know, we have a situation here where we continue to have conflicting numbers. And it's what's so frustrating to politicians and so forth that have to do with whether or not the economy is growing, which, of course, it is very smartly. GDP is growing at or above its potential, which is exactly what we would want. And there's no doubt that we have essentially full employment. So the labor market is an astounding number. Yet people are still very, very upset about the economy. And they're taking it out on the politicians when they're surveyed about the upcoming election. And so you figure, what could possibly be behind that? So a couple of economists did a study, which is going to be consistent with what we're seeing in the world today. And they asked the fundamental question, which is worse when it comes to incomes for the average American household? Is a recession worse, or is a bout of bad inflation worse? And they decided, based upon the data that they had, that wages fall more for more people, and is more damaging under an inflationary period than it is under a recession. So if we had a choice, which evil do we want? Do we want a recession or do we want a bout of inflation? It turns out that the recession, of course, creates unemployment, which is a really bad outcome, especially for those who are directly affected. But it's usually much, 8% or less of the households that have wage earners. And then we kind of soften that by having unemployment compensation, which means that their wages or their incomes don't fall quite as much. But when it comes to inflation, it affects every single family. So, for example, over the past 3 years, I just ran some numbers yesterday to make sure that they were still relevant. The amount of increase in general prices to buy a basket of goods in 3 years has gone up about 18%. I have an exact number here, 18.9%. But the average raise for the average American has only gone up 14.2%. So even though people are getting more money, we're actually having paychecks which are larger. When we take those paychecks to the store and to the gas station and to pay our rent and to buy a used car or whatever, they don't go as far. And this is what is becoming so aggravating to Americans. And so that's why inflation, Milton Friedman, once of the University of Chicago, referred to inflation as a general tax. It affects everybody, and it's a negative effect on people's households.
Whereas with the recession, say, then unemployment falls to 8%, that is still manageable for 92%. If you were making national policy, you would say, all right, we'll help the 8% that are unemployed or underemployed. We can manage that. Better to have 8% of the people suffer a lot than everybody suffer a little.
Yeah, I think that's what they found, and they did focus. They didn't focus on, for example, household well-being and so forth, which is very damaging, very damaged by a recession and unemployment. They focused specifically on household incomes, but just in general, there's no doubt that society has a way to deal with a downturn like a recession, with something called unemployment comp. Since the 1930s, we've had that in place in most and all states, and so we actually have a way of ameliorating the problems related to a recession.
Yeah.
We don't really have such a thing in place when it comes to inflation. It's really hard.
So you would agree then with what the Fed is doing right now, I presume?
Yeah, I happen to think I was surprised earlier this year that they were saying, oh yeah, we're going to have three cuts. I thought that was premature. And a promise that I thought at the time, they may not be able to keep. And I think Jerome Powell, just yesterday, he was in a panel discussion, and he essentially said, I think reading between the lines, that essentially there may be no cut in interest rates this year. Because, inflation was coming down really smartly. And then in June of 2023, which was, 9 months ago, it hit around 3.2, 3.5 on a year-over-year basis. It has not fallen below that in those 9 months. So we were making great progress, and then it just stopped dead in its tracks. And I think the Fed sees that, and they think that they have to put pressure on the economy for a longer period of time to, in a sense, soften the spending, which, can help feed inflation, and to make sure that the money supply does not continues to be in a size which is appropriate for the current economy. And so I don't think the Fed has any room to cut, certainly not for the next 3 or 4 months, and maybe not for this entire year, because they have to also worry about the election coming up. They do not want to be perceived as being political, that they would all of a sudden lower rates right before the election. Even if that were the right economic decision, it would have bad effects on the Fed's reputation.
And you don't think lowering rates now or then is a good idea anyway?
Not based upon the current data, looking at what has happened to inflation.
Well,
there was a big expectation that housing, rental prices were going to fall. They haven't fallen. And one other thing people tend to watch is the commodity price index, which has to do with the price of strategic inputs that firms buy. And unfortunately, that index since the beginning of the year has been rising and rising substantially, which is generally, historically, a sign of rising prices in the future. So I'm sure the Fed sees this and they're thinking, there's not a lot of good signs that general prices are going to fall anytime soon.
Right. Of course, we were warned about a coming recession all along anyway, and it seems to have never happened. And I'm not going to suggest that a recession is a cure, but is it possible that in the process of lowering inflation, we will in fact trigger that recession? And if so, is that okay? Is that actually what we're banking on here, Mike, in just a minute? Michael Miller is on a line right now. He is the economics professor at Western Washington University. Let's get you more business news first. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Indiana grocery store chain Strachan Van Til is being acquired by Iowa-based Hy-Vee. Financial terms of the deal haven't been disclosed, but the purchase is expected to be completed next month. Strachan Van Til will retain its name but will become a subsidiary of Hy-Vee. Strack has 22 locations in northwest Indiana and 2,800 employees. Hy-Vee has 240 retail locations in eight states, including Illinois and Wisconsin. Employees at Chicago's Shedd Aquarium have announced they're forming a union. A letter of intent has been signed by 60 Shedd workers. When certified, the group says the Shedd Workers Union will represent about 300 employees at the aquarium, including the departments of animal care, learning and community, guest relations, facilities, and more. Shedd is the latest cultural institution in Chicago to unionize following the Field Museum, the Art Institute of Chicago, and the Museum of Contemporary Art. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and I've got a game of Name That Tune. Ready? Who that is and why I'm playing that song after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, the hint again. Yes, it's Sir Paul and the Beatles.
Rocky Raccoon checked into his room.
And that's the problem. The rooms raccoons are checking into are often in our attics and crawl spaces and other places they can get into, especially this time of year because it's baby time for mama raccoons.
Yeah, we're in that time frame right now.
That's Stan McTaggart of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources.
They've learned that they can utilize our structures for denning areas. You know, that's a safe, dry place for them. And they get in and have their litters and, yeah, they can do a lot of damage.
In Illinois and nationwide, the raccoon population has been booming for decades, and Stan says we are part of the reason. We make it way too easy for these wild animals to thrive.
Yeah, they're very, very adaptable, pretty smart critters. They've figured out they can find all the things they need to survive, you know, food, water, and shelter. Humans seem to do a good job of providing that for them.
Oh, I know they can be cute, and you might think it's a good idea to feed them.
No, that's just really a bad idea.
And he says to keep the raccoons away, you should clean up around your bird feeder, and if you feed your pets outdoors, be sure to clean up there too. And if you think old Rocky has checked into your attic or elsewhere,
they probably don't have one. They probably have a female and a litter.
And you may want to leave the removal to a professional.
There's a lot of folks that have nuisance wildlife control businesses, contractors that that do this for a living. They provide a lot of knowledge with their service that they can educate folks on why the animals are there in the first place and how to tighten things up and prevent access from them getting into those places.
Yeah, good luck to all who are dealing with raccoons. On the food calendar, it's National Animal Crackers Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
He is a professor of economics at Western Washington University. Longtime guy to Paul, longtime guy here at WGN Radio. Mike's been telling us that were you to decide, you take lower inflation and suffer higher unemployment. And I was wondering if the Fed is therefore on the sort of trigger, if there's a greater possibility then that we'll have a recession, Michael.
I'm hoping the answer is no. And that the and by the way, the discipline of economics, although our forecasting is quite pathetic, we've lowered the probability of a recession going forward from like 1 in 40% down to like 29%. So it has been a pretty substantial drop. Most economists think we're going to somehow get through this particular event without a recession. And while a really bad recession would take care of the inflation. I think that would be true. That is not necessarily the best or the only way to fight an inflation period like this. One would be, as the Fed has done, to get the money supply under control. But, you know, one thing you could do is you could stimulate or encourage entrepreneurship for people to come up with new ideas and new businesses to make it easier, for example, for energy prices maybe to fall in terms of drilling a little bit more. So in other words, if we could do some supply-related things that would raise productivity of the American worker and so forth, which means we would produce more goods that are available for the money that's out there, then maybe that inflationary pressure would begin to fall. The Fed's approach and people who are saying we need a recession to end the inflation think that everything is on the demand side. If we would just stop buying, well, I'm not convinced that's the only way to go. Certainly, a reduction in spending will soften inflation, but it's not necessarily the answer or the solution that we should try to work with.
One other question for you, and that is, you wrote that our average raise, you just mentioned this a minute ago, since January of 2021 has been 14.2%, but in fact, prices have increased almost 19% since January of 2021. Why is January 2021 the line in the sand that we draw? I mean, of course, the numbers are elevated during the pandemic.
That is correct. That was part of it, but the pandemic, of course, began in 2020, and inflation had not yet ticked up. If you look at the
right, but all of those dollars had not been circulated through the economy yet either, right? I mean,
that's correct. There's no doubt that Mr. Biden's spending on the pandemic, which was necessary to make people whole because the government told us to stay home and so forth, that the amount of spending there did spike that inflation. And I've argued all along that part of the inflation was caused by this enormous increase in the amount of government spending, which was financed by the printing of money. So it just so happens that Mr. Biden became president around January 2021. And it was not long after that inflation took off. Now, it could be that had Mr. Trump won the election, it would have taken off just as much. It's hard to say what the spending would have been under the Trump administration. I'm sure it would have been maybe not quite as substantial as Mr. Biden, but it would have been enough to spark some a substantial rise in inflation. So it's not necessarily Mr. Biden's fault, but once we had to go fight it, then the key is, if spending is part of the problem, maybe government could draw back. Because it's still spending a very, very high percentage of GDP, historically speaking. The government is still spending a lot of money compared to, say, pre-pandemic times.
We're out of time, Michael. There are other things to get to, but you were thorough on this and most interesting. Let's take up the other topics next time.
That would be great, John. Anytime.
Michael Miller is an economics professor in Washington.